Whitmer on board?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm here. Mr. Schlepp from Wise.
And this is Steve Whitmer. I'm here.
Excellent. All right. Then, Mr. Schlepp, we're ready when you are, sir. Do you wish to reserve any time?
I would, Your Honor. If it would please the court, I would like to reserve 3 minutes.
Yes, sir.
Your Honors, may it please the court, good morning from very snowy Wise County. We're still recovering from our state of emergency, and I managed to dig out enough to make it to the office today, but nobody else did. So, but may it please the court, we're asking the court on behalf of Mr. Curtis to reverse the conviction for two reasons, both of which involving admission of prejudicial testimony, the first being that he previously sold drugs or did drugs with the confidential informant, and the second from the police expert describing the different types of cocaine, the drug use in the community, and the drug culture. If I may first address the first issue, and that is the admission of what we believe is irrelevant, inadmissible, and highly prejudicial testimony. If I may direct the court's attention to the appendix, page 16 and 17, in which the confidential informant is testifying, and she is asked the question, have you ever done drugs with the defendant? Yes, she responds. Done crack with him or done cocaine with him? She replies, smoked crack, bought crack from him, yeah, prior to February 13th, yes. She then goes on and testifies that she'd previously purchased drugs from the defendant. Generally, the rule is that prior bad acts and misconduct is not admissible. It confuses the jury. It tends to prejudice. It shows criminal propensity and depravity. Under Rule 2404, it is not admissible, and the admission of it is prejudicial and not just harmless error, as the Commonwealth argues. The Jones case that was not cited in my brief, it's Jones versus Commonwealth from the Court of Appeals in 1994, 18 VA App 329. Quoting from that case, in the prosecution of distribution or possession of drugs with the intent to distribute, the fact that an accused has sold drugs on a prior occasion where the prior sale is not shown to have been related to the charged offense has great potential for prejudice. And in that particular case was prejudicial, and the court reversed the conviction. The Commonwealth, in its brief and at trial, argued that this evidence was shown. Your Honor, did I miss a question?
Yes, this is Judge Bennett. Are you on the speakerphone?
I am, Your Honor. Do I need to take it off?
I wonder if you could use the handset. When you're on the speakerphone, sometimes it's hard for us to interject with a question.
Yes, sir. I'm taking it off. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I want to take you back to something you said a moment ago. You said that the testimony of this, I guess she's not so much a confidential informant now that she testified, but
sure.
You said that it was not harmless error. This mm-hmm. seems to be a pretty overwhelming case of guilt. Can you explain to me why that statement is so prejudicial that it's not harmless error?
Well, Your Honor, if I may, it's strange enough that overwhelming guilt, but yet there were two mistrials before this third conviction. And so I would argue that maybe, perhaps while on the surface it appears that way, the Commonwealth case had significant problems, and that the biggest significant problem was that their confidential informant was not the best witness, so to speak. This individual...
Did I get this wrong? Did they have videotape?
There was a videotape, yes, Your Honor. It did show the quote-unquote transaction. It did not show what happened before and what happened after. And our argument was that perhaps, as these confidential informants, as the officers admitted, tend to do, might have switched something or might have done something. And so we played on the doubt that the confidential informant herself created based on her testimony. Now, I would say that, sure, there is a video, but yet just the video by itself would not be enough. And the Commonwealth attempted, essentially, our argument is, to bolster its testimony, knowing that they were going to rely on this confidential informant and her reliability as a witness, and admitting that there was chances that these confidential informants cheat and take some of the materials or switch things, that that this lady is not their most credible witness. And then in order to bolster that testimony, they come before the court, before the jury, and say, well, yeah, I know my gal is not great. I know she's not the most trustworthy witness. I know she's a drug dealer and a user herself. But she did drugs with him before, and he sold her drugs before, and thus he must be guilty now. And I think that's really the problem here, Your Honors. What we have is we have testimony that does not show, as the Commonwealth tries to argue, that he had intent or knowledge of the events. I would direct the court's attention to my brief when I discussed the Eccles, Boyd, and Cooper case, and in particular on page, I believe, 9 and 10 of my brief, where I discussed that the Commonwealth didn't need this testimony to show knowledge to meet its burden. That was unnecessary. The testimony was, though, merely to bolster the credibility of their own witness and to just put my client, Mr. Curtis, in a bad light, to prejudice him in the eyes of the jury. We submit that that's not only improper, but when it's done, the Jones case and others speak that that is prejudicial and the prejudice is not harmless error. And based on, of course, an abuse of discretion standard, while we do have a judge that's given discretion, and we're not going to interfere with that judgment on evidence rulings, that judge does not have discretion to admit prejudicial and inadmissible evidence. And that's what he did here. We have these specific lines of the transcript that I pulled out. There's others in context, but these particular are just totally unacceptable. And we argued that before trial, during trial, after trial, and still arguing it. We ask that the Commonwealth's case be reversed. In the Anderson versus Commonwealth case, 19 VA App 64 in 1994, this court said the burden is on the Commonwealth to establish the defendant knew the nature and character of the materials he was charged with distributing, but that does not mean the defendant must know the accurate, precise name of the drug, only the substance distribution of which is illegal. And so while I know the Commonwealth points to the Rodriguez case and others to show that this is necessary for showing intent and knowledge, we submit that it is not, and that's just a smokescreen. If you allow this, what you're doing is allowing the court to take that exception and making it swallow the rule that this sort of thing is acceptable. We submit it is not. Moving on to my second, unless there's any other questions or comments, they're moving on to the second assignment of error, and that is with regard to this expert police testimony. We argued various times that this testimony was not only unnecessary, but improper. The Commonwealth called Richard Stallard, who was a member of the Drug Task Force, a police officer for the town of Big Stone Gap, to testify as to the differences between crack and powder cocaine, how it's ingested, how one shoots up or snorts cocaine, or how it is consumed. And in the course of his testimony, he described how many cases he'd worked in Wise County, the number of them that were cocaine-related. Essentially, this testimony, we have compared it to that testimony in the Smith case, in which the Supreme Court said that when we're talking about medical dangers or dangers of cocaine or drugs in general, LSD in that particular case, that's improper because it tends to confuse the jury and inflame the jury.
Mr. Slim, it's Judge Petty again.
Yes,
It seems as if you have somewhat overstated the testimony of this detective at trial. I don't find any testimony about the inherent dangers of cocaine or the drug problem in Wise County. It seemed to me it was more just of a reference as to how cocaine is sold.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that I'm overstating it. Perhaps I'm drawing some inferences on that testimony, and knowing the way juries in Wise County think, and knowing what, in particular, the reaction of the jury when this testimony was given, and that being, you've got an officer testifying that I've worked X number of thousands of cases of drug problems in Southwest Virginia. knowing people snort this, people shoot it up. These sorts of things are bad.
But did he say that? Did he say
no, Your Honor, not particularly.
Bad,
no.
Did he reference the drug problem in Wise County?
He did not say the words. I'm sorry, Your Honor. He did not say the words drug problem in Wise County. He did not say this is causing inherent danger to people. Okay, and so thus it is not exactly like that testimony that was offered in the Smith case. But what we're arguing is that it has the same potential for harm as that which was argued and presented to the court in the Smith case.
What was the sentence he received?
He received a 6-year sentence.
And 5 years is the minimum. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. That's correct.
It doesn't sound like the jury was too outraged about the drug problem in Wise County.
It depends on how you look at it. Mr. Curtis doesn't believe that. Of course, he is deprived of 6 years of his freedom.
But he couldn't have received, but, I mean, the 5-year sentence was the minimum he could have received from that jury.
That's correct.
Mr. Slim, you're at the 3-minute mark, just so you're
Thank you, Your Honor. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning, Judge Huffman. May it please the court. The argument that was presented at trial and on brief really is that the testimony of Missy Smith was irrelevant. And it wasn't irrelevant, but it was evidence that carried the possibility of prejudice to the defendant, which is a different argument. And with respect to that argument, the defendant arguably had a remedy available that was pointed out to him by the Commonwealth at the very beginning of what turned out to be a lengthy chain of proceedings, which is if a defendant loses on the argument, this is irrelevant, but it's evidence that still has the possibility of prejudice, he can ask the court to give the jury a curative instruction or cautionary instruction. And this was never done in this case. And while I acknowledge this is essentially double-edged evidence, it can be used one way, and the way the trial court ruled it was admissible.
What did the Commonwealth present as justification for this evidence?
I would have to go back and check the record for that, Your Honor, because I did not recite the Commonwealth's argument in my brief. I do know that the trial court ruled that it was relevant for identity and to prove the defendant's knowledge of the action that he was engaged in. And clearly that was at issue in the case. In fact, at sentencing, the defendant lied about what he had been distributing to Missy Smith. So he all along has been maintaining, no, this was not cocaine, or at best possibly he didn't know it was cocaine. And the trial court found that that testimony, which was offered during the sentencing phase of the proceeding rather than during the trial proper, the trial court found that testimony was perjured. So this was admissible, but it was admissible evidence with a possibility of prejudice. By not requesting a cautionary instruction, the defendant has maximized the prejudice, and for that reason, we're arguing his complaint should not be heard on appeal. Aside from that, with respect to both pieces of evidence, it's pretty clear that the evidence in this case was overwhelming. It included a videotape of the transaction, included still photos from which the jurors could determine that the man sitting in the courtroom was the same as the man who sold drugs to Missy Smith.
What was the purpose of the testimony of Officer Stallard? Why did the Commonwealth think that was in any way relevant to this case?
Is that Judge Petty?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yes, yeah, no, that's okay. Judge Petty, I think the only thing it really adds is information about what was meant when Smith asked to purchase a 50 and Curtis delivered to her a 50, because it's not intuitive to jurors that things are sold by dollar amounts as opposed to by quantity or weight. And that's the primary relevance of the testimony.
The testimony wasn't limited to that. He testified to how many drug cases he'd been involved in and how many of those involved cocaine. And I mean, it seemed to go on a little bit more of expansive testimony than seems to be relevant at first blush. I just wondered if there was any argument as to why all of that was germane to the issue.
Well, in order to qualify the officer as an expert, the Commonwealth had to introduce testimony about his training and experience in narcotics.
But he didn't testify as an expert, did he?
I don't know if they formally qualified him as an expert. I thought I was under the impression that his testimony about what was meant by a 50 really was in the nature of expert testimony, because that would have been a matter outside of the common knowledge of jurors. In the absence of a need to qualify him, perhaps some of that evidence was more than necessary, but that's not the claim that's raised on appeal. The claim that's raised on appeal is that this was testimony about the medical dangers of cocaine. And as we've pointed out in our brief, the trial court expressly said the witness did not testify to that. And I think this court recognizes also that the record falls far short of testimony about the medical dangers of cocaine. And as with the testimony of Missy Smith, this evidence is entirely harmless in light of the vast evidence in the record. The suggestion by Mr. Curtis at this stage of the proceedings that the Commonwealth's evidence was not in good shape at this trial because there had been two previous mistrials is just not well taken. There is nothing in the record that suggests why the two prior cases ended in a mistrial, and there's nothing to suggest that the witness's testimony wasn't believed by the jurors the third time around. And what the demeanor of various witnesses might have been like during the first two trials, we can't know. What we do know is that the jurors believed the testimony in this case and believed the evidence they saw with their own eyes, the videotape and the photos of the defendant. And for those reasons, we would ask the court to affirm.
All right. Anything further?
If I may rebut, Your Honor?
Well, is he...
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
That's fine. Mr. Whitmer, anything?
Oh, no, I've concluded, Your Honor, unless there are further questions from the court.
I did not want to cut you off prematurely.
No.
Yes, Mr. Schlemp, you have 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor. I didn't mean to cut him off either.
That's one of the difficulties with his phone hearings, and I appreciate everyone just bearing with us through it.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you for accommodating us. Well, let me respond to a couple things. First, the Commonwealth admitted that this testimony does have a double-edged sword, a double-edged evidence, I believe is what opposing counsel referred to it as. And instead of arguing that the evidence was necessary for proving an element of an offense, as the Commonwealth did at trial, if you look at page 18 of the appendix, instead, they argue that we've somehow waived it because we didn't ask for a jury instruction. Limiting instruction. Instead, at trial, we said, this isn't relevant, you shouldn't admit it. We preserved the error, and we argue that the error is preserved. In the Jones case, in other cases that I've cited, you didn't have to ask for a limiting instruction to prevent inadmissible evidence from being presented. And so that argument we find is not well taken. The next, regarding the medical dangers and regarding Richard Stallard's testimony, I don't want the court to be confused by the Commonwealth's argument that our testimony is only about medical dangers. And in fact, at trial, we, and on brief, we've argued more. We've argued that this is not only like medical dangers and thus irrelevant and prejudicial and everything else, but it's also irrelevant, has no tendency to prove anything related to guilt, merely confuses the jury, and thus must should not have been admitted at trial. And so we find that the Commonwealth's argument on kind of deflecting the smokescreen of this is not enough, like Smith, is not sufficient to prevent that argument. There's more there. There's that this was confusing to the jury, that this was inflamed the jury, that this was just not was not relevant, did not need to be presented to the court. Likewise, the testimony of Smith was not necessary to be presented to the court. Also regarding the mistrials, the previous trials, we submitted in the appendix that there are the transcripts of the previous trials, and the court will find that there is there were questions that were submitted to the court from the testimony at the mistrials, that there was specific questions related to stuff. So I asked the court to maybe look back through that. If the court's worried about those prior trials, the Commonwealth said that there was absolutely no evidence, but their transcripts are in there from the prior trials. Essentially, Your Honors, we asked the court reverse because the rules are pretty clear. You can't present this kind of evidence, and if you do, it's error. It's prejudicial. It confuses the jury. While there are exceptions, we can't allow the exceptions to swallow up the rule. The Commonwealth hasn't argued these exceptions here today, and neither in the brief, and so we asked the court reversed the convictions. Thank you, Your Honors, for your time.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Now we move on.